The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Over the past 36 hours, the United States and its partners have launched Operation Epic Fury.
The world just got safer today because of all the leaders that were taken on. And God willing, if the mission is done, the world's going to be a safer place.
Do you and the president care who runs the country now? Or you can just kind of sit back and kind of shape it from the sea and the air?
Ultimately, Jesse, whatever happens with the regime in one form or another, it's incidental to the president's primary objective here, which is to make sure the Iranian terrorist regime does not build a nuclear bomb.
We're doing very well on the war front, to put it mildly, I would say. Somebody said, on a scale of 10, where would you rate it? I said about a 15.
Multiple people familiar with the plan are telling CNN that the Trump administration is working to arm Kurdish forces, who they then expect to take part in a ground operation in Iran in the coming days.
Some Iranians are concerned that the Kurds will carve out kind of an autonomous region as they did in Syria and Iraq.
We're not looking to the Kurds going in. We're very friendly with the Kurds, as you know, but we don't want to make the war any more complex than it already is. No. We don't want, I have ruled it out. I don't want the Kurds going in. War is complicated enough without getting the Kurds involved.
We're winning the war by a lot. We've decimated their whole evil empire.
We don't want to come back every 5 years or every 10 years and do this. So we want to pick a president that's not going to be leading their country into a war.
So right now, growing questions about the future of Iran as the terror regime names the Ayatollah's son as its new supreme leader. He's a hardline cleric, widely considered more radical than his dad.
President Trump warning, quote, he's going to have to get approval from us. If he doesn't get approval from us, he's not going to last long.
The president said recently there will be no deal with Iran except unconditional surrender.
Mm-hmm.
What does that look like, unconditional surrender? How will you know it's real?
It means we're fighting to win. It means we set the terms. We'll know when they're not capable of fighting. But what I think some folks have been confused by is that our will might be limited, or our capabilities might be limited, or our munitions might be limited. They're wrong. And the Iranians are wrong to miscalculate American will and American authorities and American capabilities and American munitions. We have just now begun to fight, just now begun to surge. What I want your viewers to understand is this is only just the beginning. We are only just now getting over the top of the country with impunity. But I would also remind your audience, it's early. It's 6 days into this campaign. 6 days.
Over the weekend, the United States military and the Israeli Defense Forces continued Operation Epic Fury very successfully. Over the past 9 days, we've carried out some of the most powerful and complex military strikes and maneuvers the world has ever seen. Now, you add that up to all of the other things, Midnight Hammer, getting rid of the nuclear threat from Iran, which was a big moment in history, in my opinion, as we're achieving major strides toward completing our military objective. And some people could say they're pretty well complete. We've wiped every single force in Iran out very completely.
Everybody said the same thing. Make sure you win. We will. We've already won in many ways, but we haven't won enough. We go forward more determined than ever to achieve ultimate victory that will end this long-running danger once and for all.
Iran's a very powerful country. They were going to take over the Middle East. If we did not hit them, they were going to take over the Middle East. So we stopped it with good timing. And we're very proud to be involved in this, and it's going to be ended soon. And if it starts up again, they'll be hit even harder.
You called it an excursion. You said it would be over soon. Are you thinking this week it will be over?
No,
talking
but soon.
About days?
I think so.
Okay, and with respect
very
to—
Very soon. Look, everything they have is gone, including their leadership. In fact, they have two levels of leadership, and even actually, as it turns out, more than that. But two levels of leadership are gone. Most people have never even heard about the leaders that they're talking about. So
It's obviously been very, very powerful, very effective.
You've said the war is, quote, very complete, but your defense secretary says this is just the beginning. So which is it, and how long should Americans be prepared?
Well, I think you could say it both. We could call it a tremendous success right now as we leave here, I could call it, or we could go further, and we're going to go further.
Everything's finished, and we've only just begun. That's a pretty good summary of these past 11 days. So many objectives, and very different, every single one of them, a different objective. So many assessments, and those are all pretty different. At least they're a little more similar. Overwhelming, obliterating, you know, we're winning, we're 15 out of 10. On a scale of 1 to 10, it's absolutely a 15. So there's an assessment that's usually very positive, but if you read between the lines, if you get all of the objectives and the changing objectives, it does reveal a lot. And again, we have made the point since the war broke out that this man right here, he deserves some credit for doing something that every other president since 1980 has failed to do. Well, really, you can put Carter in the mix as well from the 1970s. They have failed to confront Iran, and he certainly has confronted them. But as you can see, and as we've seen for decades, I mean, this is yet another limited war. There are limitations to it, obviously. There's awesome power on display, and we've made this point too. But just like so many of the other wars since the end of World War II, what we're seeing is America fighting a war in a very limited way. There are restrictions, for sure. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We appreciate you joining us on today's show. There's just so many lessons. What I feel like has been impressed on my mind is just, you know, you do see the courage of Jeroboam. You do see someone that has confronted this menace. But it also just exposes the weakness of Manasseh, the weakness of America these past 47 years. I mean, finally, we're getting some perspective. You're hearing members of the administration talking about these 47 years, how that Iran has been at war with America for nearly a half century, which is true. But why so much weakness? Lee Smith has an article about, or maybe it's Victor Davis Hanson, I've got both of them in my notes, making the point that for the longest time, we just felt like, well, to go, and you saw this after 9/11, we'll go after Iraq, we'll go after Afghanistan. I mean, they at least labeled Iran, George W. Bush and his people, as part of the axis of evil, but they didn't confront Iran. They wouldn't confront Iran because that was seen as, well, if we do that, then there's just going to be an explosion of violence. And the whole world's going to be drawn into it. It's going to be the start of a world war. And here President Trump comes along and he gets down to business. And, well, what we see is very quickly the United States and Israel, they gain control of the skies over Iran. Iran, according to Hegseth, I mean, they're firing fewer ballistic missiles than they have since the start of the war. So they've been set back. And then you add Operation Hammer to the mix last summer. There's no question, but it's also exposed how America could have done this years ago, decades ago. But we wouldn't. Too much weakness. It's like it's straight out of the pages of Leviticus 26, which we'll get to in a bit. But another angle, and this is certainly something we've been thinking on a lot with our news gatherers and such, is just how this is clearly ambiguous. The objective here, or the objectives, plural, and they're very, very different. And there have been quite a few commentaries talking about how that, well, this is just President Trump's approach. You know, he's the master at misdirection. He says one thing and then does another. Or something happens, he exaggerates the effect, or he says something exaggerated to try to get a rise out of the media. But if you think about, I mean, these are maybe negotiation tactics that could have worked in business, I suppose. Maybe this is how, you know, Kushner and Witkoff operate when they're sitting down with Hamas or whoever. But when it comes to war, I mean, misdirection and confusing statements or contradictory statements, this is not the sign of strength. It's not the sign of, it's certainly not the sign of unlimited war if necessary. And again, if you just go back and look at history, there's some powerful lessons that we can draw from that. And of course, we've got the advantage of Bible prophecy as well, the sure word of Bible prophecy. But since the end of World War II, one of the biggest weaknesses of the Israelite nations, particularly Ephraim and Manasseh, the United States and Britain, by the way, I mean, they're as weak as ever, and they're being exposed by this effort and by President Trump, the weakness. But going back to the end of World War II, I mean, the way America and Britain have fought wars is with a limited approach. Unconditional surrender, you heard there in the cold open. What does that mean? And notice the response. Well, it means we're fighting to win. What? Unconditional surrender on the part of Iran means that we, America, are fighting to win? Okay. Well, that's quite a definition. He also said, we'll know, this is Hegseth, we'll know when Iran is not capable of fighting. So I guess that's part two of the definition of unconditional surrender. Think about what it took to get Japan, for example, to unconditionally surrender at the end of World War II. I mean, you could make a case that that's about the only time in history that a nation has unconditionally surrendered by aerial warfare. We dropped two bombs that destroyed entire cities. But this time around, it's limited. We're certainly not going to drop a nuke. So we've got all of these missiles that we expect to bring Iran to the point of unconditional surrender. And that just doesn't happen. They've got their new supreme leader. He's more radical. He's the son of Ayatollah number two. So we're into the third Ayatollah now. And Iranians haven't taken to the streets demanding regime change. The fruits of limited war. When you're fighting a war with specific limitations put upon your own power, it means that your war aims are also limited. They have to be. And you can throw out unconditional surrender all that you want, but then as the assessments come in and they're ever-changing, then you have to define it as, well, we're fighting to win. Well, okay, everybody's fighting to win, but what does unconditional surrender mean? And, you know, there's some pretty powerful spiritual lessons in all of this, particularly as we come into the Passover season. What does it mean to unconditionally surrender to God, or to lay a siege on our sins to the point where the devil has to unconditionally surrender? Draw near to God, resist the devil, and he'll flee from you, the scriptures relate. You look at history, you look at Churchill's approach when basically Britain reluctantly brought him in because they knew they were engaged in what would be a horrific war that would go on for years. This is from Winston Churchill's War Leadership by Martin Gilbert. In his first speech in the House of Commons as Prime Minister in May of 1940, while he was still in the process of forming his government, Churchill began by setting out the dangers that were confronting Britain. And then it quotes Churchill, "I would say to the House, as I said to those who have joined this government, I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. You ask, what is our policy? I will say it is to wage war by sea, land, and air with all our might. To wage war, we're going to do it by sea, we're going to do it by the air, and we're going to do it on land as well. In other words, the aim here is for Germany to unconditionally surrender. He went on to say, and with all the strength that God can give us to wage war against a monstrous tyranny, never surpassed in the dark, lamentable catalog of human crime, that is our policy. You have to give him credit. I mean, the British people, the Western world, I mean, they knew right where he stood. We're going to marshal all of our forces and look to the great God to fight this monstrous tyranny. And he did. Gilbert says Churchill went on to present the members of Parliament with his astonishing vision. You ask, what is our aim? I can answer in one word. It is victory. It is victory. It just seems like these words are a lot more meaningful and carry much more weight than just saying, what does unconditional surrender mean? Well, it means that we're fighting to win. Well, that's kind of ambiguous. What does a win look like? Because as I said last week, we heard last summer, the whole, I mean, just saying that the nuclear program was obliterated, it undermines what you're saying this time around, 8-9 months later. Well, if it was obliterated, if they're not capable of fighting, is that unconditional surrender? Isn't that a victory? Well, no, coming into this one, it was justified by the fact that they were just days away from putting together nuclear weapons and bragging about it to Kushner and Witkoff. Gilbert says, the words a monstrous tyranny highlighted another faucet of Churchill's leadership, his clarity as to the purpose of the war. From the outset of the fighting, when he was First Lord of the Admiralty and a member of Chamberlain's War Cabinet, he was able to convey to the British public something they overwhelmingly felt within themselves, that it was a just war, a war being fought against evil. See, now you have to, again, this time around, with a Jeroboam figure in power, you have to also consider, you know, the people that he's leading, and just how, as we've said, the Americans have no stomach for this. So many of them, even many in the MAGA movement. You talk about ever-changing commentary or objectives or assessments. You see it in the media, too. And you see the media sounding the alarm as soon as seven U.S. soldiers are dead, and as soon as gas prices go up 30 or 40 cents. In a lot of ways, I mean, Donald Trump, he hamstrings himself because he has so many different objectives, and they're all, you know, the best it's ever been. We've got to win a war, and we've got to do it quickly. We've got to win the midterms bigger than ever. You know, we've got to have a booming economy to do that. And we're also celebrating our birthday, and it's a golden age. So everything's just getting better and better and better. And anything that would slow any of those things down, well, like Mr. Hilliker wrote in his brief yesterday, you can begin to describe a loss or a stalemate as a stunning victory and then just kind of dust off from it and move on. Or as we know, as we know will happen, hand it over to Europe. Hand it over to Germany. And there's another storyline here, a very important one. The fact that it's perfect cover for Europe to move into Cyprus, for Europe to engage, to expand the empire. Well, we've got to do it. The world is at war. Churchill's clear understanding of the issues at stake enhanced his leadership of the nation even before he became prime minister. That vision was conveyed both in speeches and broadcast to the British public, and in secret to his closest colleagues in government. He had a clear vision, a clear objective. His colleagues knew it. his associates, his government when he finally formed it in May of 1940, and then the whole country, the whole Western world. And Hitler certainly understood Churchill's objectives too. This time around, it's a little different. It does just make you, again, appreciate President Trump's courage for doing something, finally, and just the lack of courage that's been there in American leadership, in British leadership, for 47 years. 47 years. I played this clip for you. I think it's number 8. It's President Trump from back in 1980 when, I think even back then, the objective was pretty clear, and there's been some commentary talking about how this has really been on Donald Trump's radar for 47 years. But the objectives back then, I mean, it's even stronger, more focused than it has been these past 11 days. Play clip 8.
When you get the respect of the other countries, then the other countries tend to do a little bit as you do. And you can create the right attitudes. The Iranian situation is a case in point. That they hold our hostages is just absolutely and totally ridiculous. That this country sits back and allows a country such as Iran to hold our hostages, to my way of thinking, is a horror. And I don't think they'd do it with other countries. I honestly don't think they'd do it with other countries.
Obviously, you're advocating that we should have gone in there with troops, et cetera, and brought our boys out.
I absolutely feel that, yes. I don't think there's any question, and there's no question in my mind. I think right now would be an oil-rich nation, and I believe that we should have done it, and I'm very disappointed that we didn't do it, and I don't think anybody would have held us in abeyance. I don't think anybody would have been angry with us, and we had every right to do it at the time. I think we've lost the opportunity.
We had every right to do it at the time. We could have used any means necessary, and the world would have stood behind us. Well, now the U.S. is in a very different position, and the calls for limited war, they get stronger and stronger and stronger. By the way, I don't know. I don't follow Russian media, but is Vladimir Putin out there every day saying, yeah, we're crushing Ukraine. That war's been going on for 4 years. Yeah, we're just about done. We've got total victory. And then are his top aides, are they saying, no, actually, we're just starting. We're about to really, this is going to be the heaviest bombardment of all right now, today. It's very unusual. It shows you how important the soundbite is. It shows you how important framing the narrative is for America, for Britain. It shows you how much the whole world is aligned against America, where we've got to get out and try to sell it every day, every single day. I mean, if you want to be unpredictable, how about if you just don't say anything and just let your actions speak for themselves? Every day. I mean, as you can see on this show, there are plenty of options when it comes to clips, when it comes to sound bites. Yeah, we're just starting. No, we're it's very complete. The operation is not just complete, it's very complete, whatever that means. And on it goes. Gilbert, just one last bit here. Knowing the nature of the enemy and making sure the nation had no doubt of the moral aspect of the conflict were important elements of Churchill's war leadership. Another aspect was his understanding of the reality of war. I mean, Ezekiel 33 verses 1 through 6 describe this man right here that you see on screen. He was a wartime leader. He understood the reality of war. He had a clear-eyed vision of Britain's objective. And as we wrote in the Trumpet a couple years back, I mean, what we're dealing with, what Israelite nations are dealing with, are madmen that have minds like beasts of the animal kingdom, predators feasting on prey. And we don't understand those minds. Not like that we should, anyway. And then added to that, I mean, we're afflicted with peace derangement, thinking that one quick operation or one obliteration will change the attitude or the mindset of a beast. That's flawed. That's misguided. How well do our leaders understand the reality of war? The Federalist, I think they're against the effort in Iran, so they're writing it from that standpoint. But it says here, they're a very conservative outlet as well. It says, why can't the Trump administration give the American people straight answers about the Iran war? We're now more than a week into epic fury, and every day that passes seems to bring new questions that Trump and his top officials can't answer consistently and coherently. Questions like, what's the goal in Iran? Why do we launch this war now? What's our theory of victory? And how will we know when we have achieved it? These four questions in particular deserve answers, and so far we haven't gotten them. Now, as I say, President Trump and his administration deserves some credit for at least confronting the beast. But I think some of the points that the Federalist brings out are valid, and it goes through some of the things you heard there in the cold open. Well, maybe we can just play you a few more standalone clips that show, you know, the ever-changing assessments and so on. This is Hegseth on his 60 Minutes interview. So this is, you know, you're about a week, 7-8 days into the war. Clip one.
What I want your viewers to understand is this is only just the beginning. We are only just now getting over the top of the country with impunity, where now the munitions we're dropping are still precision-guided munitions. We've got unlimited supplies of them, and we'll be picking those targets and sinking those boats. But I would also remind your audience, it's early. It's 6 days into this campaign. 6 days.
It's early. We're only just beginning, he says. This piece, I wonder if I deleted this when I came up. The Lee Smith piece we'll get to. It's just an article that talks about unlimited war. Well, that answers that statement there that you just heard. We have got unlimited equipment, missiles, technology. And the article just goes through the cost. I mean, the actual financial cost of war. It's breaking the back of America economically, or it soon will. We know this. That was Hegseth on Sunday night. Here he is again. This is from the same interview. Clip two.
President said recently there will be no deal with Iran except unconditional surrender. Mm-hmm. What does that look like, unconditional surrender? How will you know it's real?
It means we're fighting to win. It means we set the terms. We'll know when they're not capable of fighting.
Fighting to win, we've set terms, and we'll know when they're not capable. A very revealing definition. So that was Sunday night. And then yesterday, Monday, this is from CBS in the early afternoon. In a phone interview, President Trump told me the war could be over soon. And this is a direct quote from President Trump. I think the war is very complete, pretty much. I think the war is very complete, pretty much. So, well, how do you respond to the fact that you say it's complete and Hegg says we're just starting? Well, I think you can say both. There you go. I think you can say both. He added that the U.S. is very far ahead of his initial 4 to 5 week estimated time frame. Very far ahead. So this isn't going to go on 4 or 5 weeks. I mean, this could be over in a few days, evidently. That was at 2:16 p.m. yesterday afternoon. At 3 p.m., here's Donald Trump at the Republican Members Issue Conference. This is, again, yesterday afternoon, clip three.
They want to make sure they said it. Everybody said it. They were separate, but everybody said the same thing. Make sure you win. We will. We've already won in many ways, but we haven't won enough. We go forward more determined than ever to achieve ultimate victory that will end this long-running danger once and for all.
Ultimate victory. We've won we haven't won enough. That was 3 p.m. Here's 5 p.m. last night at his presser, clip four.
Over the weekend, the United States military and the Israeli Defense Forces continued Operation Epic Fury very successfully. Over the past 9 days, we've carried out some of the most powerful and complex military strikes and maneuvers the world has ever seen. Now, you add that up to all of the other things, Midnight Hammer, getting rid of the nuclear threat from Iran, which was a big moment in history, in my opinion. But while we're doing all of these things, we're achieving major strides toward completing our military objective. And some people could say they're pretty well complete. We've wiped every single force in Iran out very completely.
Every single force in Iran wiped out very completely. He's using very quite a lot. Federalist says the administration's inability to be clear and consistent on these major questions is a huge problem, whether you support the war or not. In fact, if you support the war, you should be particularly unsettled by Trump's shifting goals and justifications because it undermines support for a conflict that's already unpopular with the majority of Americans. It says this isn't nitpicking. In a democratic republic like ours, it matters how our leaders communicate about something as serious and deadly as war, especially when we're the ones who launched it. The American people should be reasonably expect their government to make a good faith effort to persuade them of the need for military action abroad, or at least make a case for it. And that's what was so brilliant about Churchill. And again, they were in full appeasement mode for years in the late 1930s. But then, you know, as Hitler brought the war to them, finally, they put forward Winston Churchill. And he spoke with clarity, with power, with courage, with faith even. He spoke with boldness. And he told the British people exactly what they were getting into, what this meant, the sacrifices that the people would have to make to go by land, by sea, by the air, any means possible to bring on unconditional surrender. Look at what it took those beast-like leaders to go through to finally come to the point of submitting to a higher power or to a more destructive power. Look at what it took for them to submit, to surrender. Have the minds of men changed since that time? Have they changed for the better in the past 70, 80 years? Is a limited aerial bombardment, is that going to bring beast-like minds to the table to surrender? As I said earlier, history certainly does. So history brings out some pretty valuable lessons for us to consider. This tip insights talking about the same thing the Federalist is. It speaks about the CBS tweet yesterday and the fact that it got 5 million views and Trump was saying it was very much complete, the effort in Iran. And then the same article says the problem was that a few hours later at a news conference in Florida, Trump appeared to reverse himself. Only hours after suggesting the war might be nearing its end, he spoke of intensifying operations and signaled that the fight could expand. This source says, "Welcome to the world of strategic ambiguity. In geopolitics, uncertainty itself can be a form of power." You know, maybe this is just Trump being Trump. Maybe this is part of Trump's strategy, just being ambiguous, unpredictable. Well, as I said at the start, it's not the sign of someone being, you know, in a power position. We can skip number five. Play clip six from last night's presser.
You've said the war is, quote, very complete, but your defense secretary says this is just the beginning. So which is it, and how long should Americans be prepared?
Well, I think you could say it both. It's the beginning of building a new country.
but they certainly, they have no Navy, they have no Air Force, they have no anti-aircraft equipment, it's all been blown up, they have no radar, they have no telecommunications, and they have no leadership. It's all gone. So, you know, you could look at that statement. We could call it a tremendous success right now as we leave here, I could call it, or we could go further, and we're going to go further.
Is it the beginning, or is it the end, or is it complete, or is it just starting? And the answer is both, both. Pete Hegseth had a presser this morning. This is clip 10, where he's, I think, responding to what the president said last night.
What I want the American people to understand is this is not endless. It's not protracted. We're not allowing mission creep. The president has set a very specific mission to accomplish. And our job is to unrelentingly deliver that. Now, he gets to control the throttle. He's the one deciding. He's the one elected on behalf of the American people when we're achieving those particular objectives. And so it's not for me to posit whether it's the beginning, the middle, or the end. That's his, and he'll continue to communicate that.
We gave you that verse from James last week, I believe, on the show, that a double-minded man, that doesn't, again, suggest strength and stability. What exactly is the objective? Well, as we're seeing, it can very much change from one day to the next. I mentioned this Victor Davis Hanson piece, our long road to war with Iran. I mean, America's been on this journey for 47 years because they've been at war with us. It says until last year, for some 46 years, Iran enjoyed a North Korea-like reputation in the heart of the Middle East, always unpredictable, reckless, dangerous, inevitably to be nuclear, self-destructed, and nihilistic. All that said, was it really ever that formidable? And you saw all these U.S. presidents over the years just cower in fear and basically go everywhere in the Middle East after 9/11 except Iran, except at the number one state sponsor of terrorism of all things. You look back in hindsight and you think, how ridiculous, how stupid was it to not go after Iran after they blew up the World Trade Center and the Pentagon and the plane that crashed in the Pennsylvania field and 3,000 Americans to go with it. And we didn't even go for the head of the snake. And then you look at this past 11-day period. Again, President Trump deserving some credit for at least confronting it. And then, as Victor Davis Hanson says, was it really that formidable in 2001 or 2002 when all the advisors to Bush said, no, that would be too much. That would be too dangerous. So let's go to Iraq. Over decades, Hanson says, they killed, wounded thousands of Americans by bombing U.S. embassies, barracks, and bases in the Middle East without directly confronting the American military. For years, they sent lethal-shaped charge IEDs to the Shiite insurgents to slaughter and maim thousands of Americans in Iraq, and to the Taliban to do the same in Afghanistan. How many thousands of Americans have returned from those war fields, dismembered, without arms or legs, blown up at the hands of Iranian insurrectionists, Iranian-made bombs, IEDs? Hanson says by 2017, Iran, for some reason, was considered all-powerful in the Middle East with its missiles, soon to be nuclear status, and Hamas, Hezbollah, and Houthi killers who would murder Westerners and Israelis year after year. It says for the last seven American presidents, the very thought of challenging Iran militarily had been considered taboo, all the more so after the American misadventures in Afghanistan and Iraq. You can go anywhere. You can confront any menace in the Middle East except Iran. Obama, for his part, He was trying to empower Iran. He wanted to change the balance of power in the Middle East to where Iran was most powerful, where Iran had a nuclear weapon. He really was sleeping with the enemy, the dear leader. It says, in sum, no one apparently realized, with the exception of Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu, that beneath its rough, ugly shell, theocratic Iran was rotten and decayed inside. Now, we shouldn't go to the extreme of underestimating Iran. They're the king of the South. And there may be some rot and decay on the inside. But there is power there. There is power, and they have support from other powerful nations, like Russia, by the way, and China. How long is it going to take for Iran to rebuild? Or how much will it take for Iran to resume its traditional position as, you know, pushing at Western powers, pushing at the King of the North? Its corruption and hatred of its own people, says Hansen, ensure that even its huge revenues and sophisticated Chinese and Russian weapons could never translate into a modern lethal military. Well, here again, don't underestimate the King of the South. But it says, so here we are in March 2026, watching the systematic destruction of the entire five-decade facade of a supposedly invincible Iranian military, the systematic elimination of its theocratic rulers or leaders, and the dismantling of the Iranian military and Revolutionary Guard terrorists. And in a lot of ways, they've certainly been hit and hit hard over the past year. It says here, we're left somewhat confused. Why did prior presidents not hold Iran accountable for its killing, thus nourishing the myth of Iranian invincibility? Why did Israel not respond earlier to Iran itself rather than just its terrorist clients? It's a good question. As we said yesterday, I mean, Gadi Taub has said that, I mean, Bibi's been waiting his whole life for this. And now you wonder, well, why did it take until last summer to finally do something? And then, of course, America, for its part, rushes in and tells Bibi to dial it back. Listen, just so that you know, since the end of World War II, we've been fighting limited warfare. And that's it. Those are the rules for our nations, including you, Judah, including you, Bibi. It's got to be limited. And America's enemies, they know this. I mean, if there's one tribe of Israel that, and because of Bibi, that may be an exception to that, it's Judah. But look at how Judah even has had to limit its effort with Hamas, with Hezbollah, with Iran, because of Big Brother in the United States. America, limited warfare. But just coming back to Victor Davis Hanson's piece here, I mean, look at how much of a curse we are under for 47 years to cower in fear. Iran hasn't been the recipient of all of these blessings of Abraham. God didn't open up the windows of heaven and just pour down blessings of peace, prosperity, power, strength to the Iranian regime. He did that to America. He did that to the British Empire. This is a nation that would have been no match for American power and greatness, for a righteous America, or at least an America that wasn't so steeped in sin. It would have been no match for America in 1981, 1989, 1995. I'm just pick a date randomly. Certainly 2001. 25 years ago, and George W. Bush couldn't do this, couldn't confront the number one state sponsor of terrorism after the greatest act of terrorism ever carried out on American soil. Really? They wouldn't have been able to even touch the United States. And like President Trump said in 1980, the whole world would have understood. The whole world, if they would have known, and if George W. Bush said, the objective here is victory, nothing short of that, and we're going to go by land, we're going to go by air, we're going to go by sea, we're going straight into Tehran, where they are the number one state sponsor of terror, and they are going to unconditionally surrender. And what would the world have said? I mean, besides Hamas, besides the streets of Gaza City or Ramallah, they would have said, hey, more power to you. It's justified. And now here we are, though, almost a half century later. And what do we have? Just a steady diet of ambiguity. Leviticus 26, verse 14, it says, but if you will not hearken unto me, this is the blessings and cursings chapter, if you will not hearken to me and will not do all these things, all these commandments, and if you will despise my statutes, verse 15, or if your soul abhor my judgments, so that you will not do all my commandments, but that you break my covenant, I will also do this unto you, verse 16. I will even appoint over you terror. Terror. I think we understand what it means to be terrorized. It's not just when a terrorist bomb blows up. It's just the thought of it. The thought of being terrorized, of an enemy coming after your people, your nation, blowing up a city with a dirty bomb or something of that effect. That's, in a lot of ways, that's the way, well, certainly since 9/11. Even after 9/11, what was the objective? Limited war. And like Victor Davis Hanson says, I mean, because of Iraq, because of Afghanistan, because there wasn't a victory there, well, America has no appetite for anything else, anything abroad. And now they hear the ever-changing objectives, all the glowing assessments. For 47 years, we thought that's just too big of a menace. I mean, that would really open up Pandora's box. That would blow up the world. And look at how that perspective has changed in 11 days. 11 days. It's like Mr. Armstrong said when, I think this is in U.S. and Britain in Prophecy, we couldn't even whip little Vietnam. And how do you, yes, Iran is not Iraq. We've made that point. 92 million people. Quite the arsenal of ballistic missiles, a navy, all those things. They used to have a navy. And look at how it just blew up or sank to the bottom of the ocean in just a few days. Verse 17, it says, and I will set my face against you, and you shall be slain before your enemies. They that hate you shall reign over you, and you shall flee when none pursues you. And if you will not for all this hearken unto me, I will yet punish you seven times more for your sins. Seven times more. Mr. Armstrong writes in U.S. and Britain, once the British peoples and the Americans, the lost Israelites, now supposing they are Gentiles, found themselves basking in the pleasant sunshine of such wealth and power, they were less willing than their ancient forefathers to yield to their God and his ways. They felt no need of him now. It seems few ever turned to God until they find themselves in desperate need or trouble. I mean, there's the token reference here and there to God. I think Hegseth had that at his presser this morning. Play that clip if you can find it. We skipped over it a moment ago.
So I'll close with scripture, drawing strength from Psalm 144. Blessed be the Lord, my rock, who trains my hands for war and my fingers for battle. He is my loving God and my fortress, my stronghold and my deliverer, my shield in whom I take refuge. May the Lord grant unyielding strength and refuge to our warriors, unbreakable protection to them and our homeland, and total victory over those who seek to harm them. And amen. God bless our troops and this mission.
There's the token references, and I'm sure he delivered it sincerely. But look at how far removed we are from God in the way that we live. Yeah, God is our, God says he'll be our shield if we obey him. I mean, a shepherd is there to protect the sheep, but he's also there to guide the sheep, to lead the sheep, to lead the sheep to green pastures. We do need a shield. We do need a shepherd. But we don't want to be ruled. That's the truth. We don't want God to rule us. God has clear objectives. God understands the reality of spiritual warfare. And we look to him to get a clear-eyed purpose and vision and objective on how we go about preparing for battle. As I say, this is a theme we'll be thinking about in depth coming up to Passover. We're coming into sobering times. God says in this passage in Leviticus that he's going to break the pride of our power. Curses are setting in. The reality of what's coming, I mean, it should be more real than it's ever been. Herbert Armstrong, I forget which year this was when he made this comment, but this is clip 11, I believe.
3 or 4 short years ago, many laughed and scoffed when I said that there would be another world war in 5 to 7 years. They do not laugh and scoff now. Everyone knows that the world war is coming, and soon. And it did come in 1939. This was written in 1934, and World War came in 1939, just 5 years after I wrote that. So once again, the plain truth, even in its first issue, was way ahead of its time. Was predicting what was going to happen. People scoffed. They said, that's a crackpot. He doesn't know what he's talking about. But World War II did happen. It did come. I have known for years, and you've heard me proclaim again and again and again, that the United States of Europe is coming. They're going to unite 10 nations in Europe. And the Vatican will be on top of the heap.
His signature prophecy. He was right. He was talking there about the 1934 issue of The Plain Truth. The first issue, February 1934, way ahead of its time. And he was right through the duration of his ministry, all the way through to his death in 1986. U.S. and Britain in Prophecy being his classic work on Bible prophecy. Here in Leviticus, verse 20 of chapter 26, it says, your strength shall be spent in vain, for your land shall not yield her increase. You're going to spend your strength in vain. Maybe next time I can bring that article about just the heavy cost for war. Strength, though, spent in vain. This is what we had to say in the Trumpet magazine just a month after 9/11. As the U.S. was, you know, marshaling its forces to head off to these campaigns in the Middle East. Not Iran, but we'll go to Iraq. We'll go to Afghanistan. At the Trumpet, we said, does America have the will to see it through? What happens when the war spreads from Afghanistan to other less isolated governments? When world opinion begins to turn on the U.S.? What happens if American soldiers begin to die? Or if retaliatory terrorist attacks on American soil intensify? Would the unanimity of public opinion fracture? Would fear intensify and determination falter? Well, that's a pretty prescient observation or take. Following 9/11, what happens when this, and this unfolds? Then what? Well, we've seen it. We can look back now over these past 25 years. And as I said earlier, I mean, we can even see the action in Iran right now, exposing a great flaw in America's approach to war. that's been there since the end of World War II. Limited warfare, unclear objectives, declaring victory when there is no victory. We've seen it so many times before. I've taken you a minute over, but I will not charge you for that extra content. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily, the fastest moving hour in broadcasting. We appreciate you joining us on this show today, and we hope that you'll join us again tomorrow.